In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Well, it's Halloween week, the time when witches and little monsters roam among us. A time when you dress up, get free stuff, and maybe get a little scared. Sort of sounds like politics in Washington, D.C. Witches, little monsters, getting stuff someone else paid for. When it comes to politics, there is nothing more scary than the mere thought of Hillary Clinton getting elected president. Notice that I did not call her a witch, but I bet you thought it. It's been a very political last 2 weeks, first with Hillary's Benghazi hearings last week, and then the debate this week, plus the election of Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House. On today's show, we're going to be taking a little deeper look at national-level politics and do what we normally do, which is to go behind the headlines and dig a little deeper. We're going to start with the Benghazi hearings and talk with Michael Ingmaier. You've probably seen him on Hannity and some other shows, you know, the ones that actually question what happened in Benghazi and not just accept whatever Hillary tells them to believe. Michael is the uncle of Sean Smith, who died in the attack on Benghazi. We still don't know exactly what happened, although we are getting inklings of why. But what has been missing and still is missing from the Benghazi hearings is an accounting of the facts. We'll talk with Michael Ingmaier in just a few moments to get his family's reaction to all of this. It has been a very political couple of weeks, and it was on full throttle bias during the CNBC debates on Wednesday. So, after digging through Benghazi, we're going to have some fun and analysis of that debate with John Hawkins of Right Wing News. We'll look at each of the candidates, get John's thoughts on who's soon to be no longer with us, and we'll take a look ahead at what a Paul Ryan speakership will mean. I'd like to welcome now Michael Ingmaier. He is the uncle of Sean Smith, one of the victims of the Benghazi attack on September 11, 2012. Michael, it's great to talk to you today.
It's good talking with you. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, we've heard you a lot on different shows, and we've read some of your articles and whatnot, and it's just a terrible tragedy what you guys, your entire family has gone through on that. But I'd like to actually start a little bit more with Sean Smith.
Sure.
To let our audience know a little bit more about him and what he was doing there, his job, and so forth. So he was an information management officer for the United States Foreign Service stationed in Libya. So what exactly does an information management officer do?
That's a good question. I mean, I only knew a little bit about Sean's job. I know he was a computer guy, an IT guy. And I guess he was there, in essence, to, you know, maintain Ambassador Stevens' computers.
Hmm.
You know, now, you know, what that entailed and involved, that's a good question. You know.
Well, there is a good question on that, and I'm going to address that in a moment here, because he was not a rookie by any sense. I mean, he started his career...
No, to the imagination. Very intelligent young man. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, he started his career in the Air Force, joined them at age 17, had a decorated service there, then later joined the State Department and served in Brussels, Baghdad, Pretoria, that's in South Africa, Montreal, and The Hague.
Right.
So what did he do on those other assignments? Do you have a sense in terms of how far afield he was going on some of those things?
That's a good question. You know, like I said, you know, my relationship with Sean was very, very brief. You know, I mean, we had a Christmas dinner together.
Hmm.
Probably about 2009, and he was just a very quiet young man. He liked to do video games. He loved reggae music. I mean, I'm trying to flesh him out a little bit here because there was more to Sean than just this picture of, you know, one of four dead Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he had two lovely children. You know, and he had a life. You know, he had an existence beyond the government. You know, and that year I made him a bunch of CDs, a bunch of reggae music, because he was a big reggae fan. He played bass on an amateur basis. You know, and so we related a little bit as musical people. He was different a little bit than I was politically. You know, he loved President Obama. He totally respected President Obama.
Hmm.
who never protected him.
Well, in terms of his jobs at some of those other department postings, like in Brussels, obviously Baghdad would have had an element of danger, but was your family surprised at all when he was sent off to Libya? And when exactly did he go? Did he go?
We had no idea he was in Libya.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
I had no idea he was in Libya. I had no idea what he was doing there. I didn't find out that he was there until we found out the next day that he was one of the people that were killed.
Wow. So since then, have you found out when exactly he sent? Was he sent while Gaddafi was still in power, or was it after the war had ended?
I think this was afterwards. He was sent not too long before the actual attack, right?
Okay. Well, given his level of expertise, you know, I'm sitting there looking at some of these long career that he's had, very successful career.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there looking at Benghazi. I mean, this is a top performer that's been sent there. Was there a need for somebody with his level of computer skills? Why exactly was he in Benghazi?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'd like to know still to this day. That's a good question. Mm-hmm. I've asked that question many times.
It just seems very strange that here's Benghazi, some 11 months after Gaddafi was killed, the whole country's still in turmoil, and it just doesn't seem like it would be a place where someone with high-tech computer skills would exactly be needed.
Right, unless you're maybe wiping servers clean. Who knows? You know, that's just all theories, a conjecture, you know, and nothing more, really. So you would think that somebody with his skill set, why would he be there?
It just does seem very, very odd.
Yeah.
In terms of communications, you mentioned that you didn't know. Do you know if his mom knew at all that he had been sent to
his
Libya?
His mother had actually talked to him, because I've talked to Pat about this before. Pat and I are pretty close, actually real close, because she realized that I was the real deal, that I really wanted to know the truth and that I wasn't a tin hat wearer, you know. I was a pretty methodical sort of person. But she had gotten a call from Sean apparently the day before he was killed, saying that he was actually frightened. He was seeing people, you know, walking around the compound taking pictures. He was seeing a building across the street from the diplomatic outpost that was waving Al Qaeda flags.
Wow!
So that shows you the sort of fear quota he was dealing with.
Well, I had seen some kind of article, I think it was Washington Post, that had said that he had made some kind of posting to a gaming site that he belonged to and the night of, and something to the fact that, you know, if we survive till morning type of thing.
Right.
I mean,
exactly. I mean, he was making a joke, but actually in a lot of ways he was being very serious.
Wow. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Lots more to go and with this tragic story with Sean Smith, who was killed there at the Benghazi compound. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Keeping an eye on big government. And this week we're talking a little bit about some national political matters, a little bit of a change for us, and we're honored to talk to Michael Ingmeyer. He's the uncle of Sean Smith, one of the victims of the Benghazi attack on September 11, 2012. So let's talk a little bit about that fateful night. One report said that on the day of his death, Smith typed a message to the director of an online gaming corporation that read that, assuming we don't die tonight, we saw one of our police that guard the compound taking pictures. And we had alluded to this in the last segment there, and so clearly he was in fear of his life.
Sure.
And
he said to his mother he was frightened, you know. And, you know, this is not, you know, a man that was easily frightened.
Well, did you get any sense, and I know that you said that his mom had talked with him the day before, but, I mean, since then, have you heard any other reports that have come out where they were expressing their concerns? I mean, obviously, you've got Stevens there that had tried to get some better security, but have you heard any other incidental things from either the other survivors or anything like that?
No, other than... No, not really, to be honest with you. Now, I did write a letter to David Ubin, okay? I don't know if you know who David Ubin
is. Yes, yes.
Okay. And, you know, David was on the rooftop of the annex with Doherty and Woods, and I wrote a thank you letter to David Ubin because and I sent it via Louis Gohmert out of Texas, you know, Congressman Gohmert, because Ubin was the guy that actually rescued Sean's body.
Wow.
And he deserved my thanks and America's thanks. You know.
Well, I do know Ubin because he was the one that had told former Congressman Bill Young, who has since died. There was an article or an interview with him on Fox News, and Bill Young had said that Ubin emphasized the fact that that was a very military style of operation. They obviously had knowledge of almost everything in that compound. They knew where the gasoline was. They knew where the generators were. They knew where the safe room was. They clearly knew more about that compound. Yeah.
Without a doubt, a paramilitary operation. It was well planned, well executed. And, I mean, they had five security operators protecting Ambassador Stevens that night. So you went from, like, and that's the craziness about it. You went from, like, in May of 2012, like 38, you know, security personnel to 30, to like something like 17, to 8, to 5. You know, and that's something that really wasn't addressed in the hearings. Like, why the reduction of personnel, especially before 9/11?
That's right. I remember you hearing you talk about that. I remember that now, but I had forgotten that when I was watching the committee hearings. You're right. Is not only did they not get the security they're asked for, but they'd actually gotten a reduction in it.
They actually got a reduction in security, and that wasn't addressed.
Hmm. Well, both you and his mom, Sean's mom, Pat, have been very clear that nobody will tell you what happened that night. And in fact, right. Pat has since said that Hillary told her at that casket ceremony it was due to a video, but has never gotten back to her since, even though Hillary had promised that she would. I'm curious, though, about that video. In the immediate aftermath, what were your thoughts about them blaming a video? I mean, obviously that's since been discredited, but here you are. You've got the most powerful man in the world saying
that.
It.
You know, I'm sorry. I never bought it. Right. You know, I just said, I don't know what happened, but I know it wasn't a damn video unless it's like Ferris Bueller's Day Off or something, you know? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm making a joke out of it, but it's just sort of like, there was no video. And then, you know, by blaming the video, this is something we were talking about offline, you know, they really actually placed our personnel in further danger. Because rather than just being honest and saying we got increased Al-Qaeda activity, we have to shut things down, we have to protect our people, we need additional security, we need military backup, all the stuff that you would do on a tangible basis, they want to blame the video and leave our people even more open than they were to begin with.
Hmm. You know, the only thing that made that video at all credible, I mean, by blaming it on that, was essentially a tacit admission that you've got these fundamentalist Muslims that are crazy, that they would be so inflamed over a video that they would do this. I mean, what's strange about that is, I mean, we actually did see that in terms, not the video, but these cartoons, that they will go off. I mean, that's what's kind of odd about that whole situation is essentially Hillary saying, yeah, Muslims are so crazy that they're willing to go off and kill people because of a video that somebody made.
Yeah, even in Cairo, where they're really trying to lay, like, you know, the blame of the video for the protests in Cairo, that wasn't happening. You know, what was happening in Cairo was basically we had done a drone attack on some Al-Qaeda operatives, and that's what they were protesting.
Hmm.
You know, it was never a video issue.
In terms of survivors here, another survivor of sorts was that filmmaker who was essentially, in my mind, taken hostage and then sent to jail, and either on a probation violation or failure to pay child support, depending on who's reporting it.
Yeah.
I believe he has since been released. I'm curious, have you or any of the Benghazi families tried to talk to him?
No, I haven't. I just decided to stay out of that entirely, you know, because one, I don't want to give him any publicity. I've watched the video. And it was sort of, to me, almost comedic more than anything.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't anything that was really to be taken seriously there.
Yeah, it was. It did seem much more kind of tongue-in-cheek almost, really.
Yeah.
It certainly didn't seem a serious... Right. Yeah, yeah. It didn't seem like a serious film at all, for sure. All right, let's go ahead and take a break right there. We'll have lots more with Michael Ingmar, the uncle of Sean Smith, one of the victims of the attack on the Benghazi compound. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're continuing our discussion with Michael Ingmar, the uncle of Sean Smith, who was killed in the Benghazi attack on September 11th. And the week of November 11th, 2013, the Benghazi survivors supposedly testified in closed-door hearings to Congress, but they've largely been kept invisible during this whole time. Because of your personal loss, has there ever been any attempt from family or friends of those survivors reaching out to you or your family?
Pat has actually been in close contact to the point that they've actually adopted her as their second mother.
Oh, wow.
And she's adopted them as sons, and that's the gentleman of the 13 Hours book, who are really, to me, you know, without a doubt, you know, American heroes. Those guys said they were given a stand-down order. I believe them. Heroes don't have to lie.
Yeah.
You know, incompetent bureaucrats do.
Yeah.
But not heroes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, heroes don't need to lie, but politicians apparently do. So
yeah. Tonto and Oz and the third gentleman, they're aces with me. And they're definitely aces with Pat. They really have looked out for Pat's interests. They have answered more questions for Pat Smith than Hillary Clinton ever did. That's for sure.
Well, speaking of Hillary Clinton, at the most recent Benghazi hearing, the committee posted two emails from Hillary, one on the night of the attack and the other on the day after the attack, and both clearly indicated that she knew that attack was not due to a video. Was that news to you when you saw that she had told her own family that night it was an Al-Qaeda type of terrorist attack?
No. I didn't know that she had emailed her family, but isn't it heartwarming, that, you know, she at least tells her family the truth.
Well,
that's not news to me, and I, you know, like I said, I never bought that.
Yeah. I didn't buy it either about the video,
but it did come as that she's duplicitous. No.
Well, I mean, I just mean the fact that that email had come to light, because I mean that's clearly a personal email. So I was surprised we even had that, but it did come as a little bit of a surprise to me that she's emailing her that night.
Yeah, I think that was probably the biggest possible revelation for America at large, you know, with Jim Jordan's cross-examination of Mrs. Clinton, and him bringing out the videos, the emails, and articulating all that really well. I'm glad that that came out, but what did the American media do? For the most part, they shrugged their shoulders and moved on.
Give her some cover. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. In terms of that Benghazi hearings, obviously you were not very pleased with them, but do you have anything in particular that just really jumped out at you in terms of this was just completely awful or anything I guess let's put it this way. If you had been sitting on that committee, what were the questions you would have asked?
I would have asked several things. I would have said, first of all, what was the national security crisis that was facing America from Libya that we needed to go in there and do what was, in essence, an illegal regime change? Why did we work with the Turi Defense Group and provide 400 tons of weapons to the Libyan Transitional National Council and not vet the people we're giving the weapons to? Why did we ignore 600 requests for additional security? Why did we not send, military personnel, or at least like an F-16 or F-14 jet to buzz the so-called protesters?
Yeah.
There's a lot of questions that just weren't asked. You know, they said at the beginning that they were going to deal with the before, the during, and the aftermath of Benghazi. Well, they dealt with the aftermath a little bit, and they touched on the before, and they touched on the during slightly. But they never really, dealt with the issues of, who gave the stand-down order? Where was the president that night?
Yeah.
There are a lot of questions that I have that were not answered.
Well, and that brings up a great point, because one of the things that I certainly saw watching that was you got Lynn Westmoreland, who he started to ask her that question, because she had just given that long spiel about the hour-by-hour, blow-by-blow type of accounting of that other attack. And he started to ask her, well, why don't you give us that same kind of hour-by-hour assessment of what you did, where you were for Benghazi? And then he just dropped it. He never actually asked her that question. And what a missed opportunity, because, like you said, we still don't know where the president was. What did he say when you called him? Did you call him? Who did you call? I mean, all of that just dropped on the floor. They didn't even touch it.
Exactly. Never dealt with it.
Do you begin getting it? You're looking at that hearing and looking at what's come out of there since then, do you get the sense that this is just purely politics and purely for show, Or do you almost get the sense that they've been told not to pursue some of these? Because to me, these are obvious questions.
Let's look at it. Let's look at it objectively, okay? Some of the people, see, you got both parties that are guilty of Benghazi. This is not just like, you know, an Obama administration screw up. You know, granted, they're the ones who sent us into Libya in the first place. But, you know, you have people like John McCain who was over there.
Yes, yes.
You know, negotiating with people that ended up being, you know, basically the Syrian rebels, and people that ended up forming ISIS.
Yes. You know? Pictures so, of him know, doing, yeah,
and John
pictures.
McCain, and John Boehner, rather, while we're speaking of, you know, Republicans that maybe have some guilty knowledge here. Look at John Boehner. I mean, John Boehner, any sort of security action, like in the sense of going into Libya and arming rebels and things like that. You know, well, the Speaker of the House knows that stuff. He's privy to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Mike Rogers of the House Intelligence Committee, right? You know? I mean, his wife was like, Christy Rogers, was responsible for providing her security company, was responsible for providing security personnel in Benghazi.
Hmm.
So that's why the House Intelligence Committee report is really like so full of holes. It's not even funny.
Yeah, well,
and that's the thing that really bothered me. There are two things that really bothered me about the hearings. One, I felt the Democrats were out of control. I thought Elijah Cummings was going to have a stroke. I'm sorry. You know, he was having these paroxysms of fits, you know, about the Blumenthal emails and things along those lines, you know.
Yeah.
And there was no appropriate decorum. They were an insult. And, you know, they said they were there to honor the victims of the Benghazi attack. Hell. They insulted them, the memories of those brave Americans, and they insulted me as a family member and all the other family members by their actions.
Yeah. Well, I can't help but think that she didn't answer that question of the hour-by-hour stuff because it's pretty clear that Obama was not involved. I mean, if he had been involved, they would have been talking about that.
Oh, yeah. MIA.
They would have been totally talking about that the next day, about how involved he was, the presidents of the different countries he'd called, the speaking with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, being on top of things. You know, they show him, they snap that one picture of him there in the Situation Room, supposedly during the Bin Laden raid. You know, so obviously, if he had been involved with Benghazi, they would have let everybody know. You know, unfortunately, we are up against the clock here with you. Lots more questions that we'd like to have answered, as I'm sure that you would. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And coming up next, John Hawkins of Right Wing News. We're going to be talking about that debate and how the CNBC hosts all turned into little monsters. Stay with us. I'd like to welcome now John Hawkins, who owns Right Wing News, one of the top news sites for conservatives, featuring great articles by top conservatives like Larry Elder, Cal Thomas, Stephen Moore, and many, many others. You know, John, after watching the CNBC Republican debate, I was reminded exactly why we need alternatives to the so-called mainstream media.
Yeah, they were, it was not great watching those guys under there just badgering them, and they were very negative, and I thought the tone of it was inappropriate a lot of times. Just talking to Trump, you know, is this a circus? It's just ridiculous. You shouldn't even be phrasing it. I mean, do you want to have a debate between the moderator and the candidate or the candidates?
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
they wanted to make a name for themselves by being pugnacious, and it was ridiculous.
Yeah. They were not there to ask questions. They were there to insult each and every one of them, maybe except for Jeff. Jeb.
Jeb doesn't need help on that front. He's a walking disaster up there. Yeah, it is, and Cruz made the point so well, and he won the debate with doing this, hammering the moderators. But you know, when the Democrats have a debate, you don't see that kind of contemptuous tone.
No.
Now, I don't want to be completely unfair. They did ask them some tough questions, but they really did not focus on asking them a whole lot of tough stuff. They didn't ask him anything with sort of an obnoxious tone, and he's right. None of the people that are up there on that stage are going to be voting Republican. There are a bunch of Democrats working. I mean, the questions, and I said this last night on Twitter, could have been written by Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They're,
you know,
they're so hostile.
Well, you know, I think in that debate they showed more investigative journalism on all of those candidates combined than they did in, what, 6 years of Hillary Clinton?
Right. The Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama get a complete pass.
Yeah.
With the Republicans, they're looking for anything they can go rip these guys down on. And it's just some of the questions. Now, it ended up being a significant question, ironically. But, I mean, they're up there asking them about fantasy football.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. This is the type of question they get. This is supposed to be an economics debate. How much economics did we really talk about? Now, Jim Cramer and Santelli, when they got up there, they did ask some economics questions, and I appreciated it. But their regular crew of moderators, they were just terrible. They did not really get into the details of a lot of these things. And it was very frustrating. And they do this for ratings. And it's really just something the Republican Party needs to take a stronger hand on. Now, I don't mind them getting some hostile questions and getting into the background of it, but I was sitting there, and we're an hour into the debate. It's 9:15 because they started 15 minutes late. They couldn't even start the debate on time. They're an hour into it, and they're still asking these guys incredibly hostile questions and trying to get them to fight with each other.
Yeah.
And it's just – it's staggering, because does this really help the Republican Party to have that kind of fist fighting going on? I don't think it does.
Well, there's a couple things on that. One, that was very interesting that they kept trying to bait them time after time, and yet the Republicans, hats off to all of them for standing strong and standing together. I really liked Huckabee's response to that. He says – I know that you want me to go after Trump there, and I'm just not going to take that bait. And that Trump would be day after day and twice on Sunday a better president than anyone on the Democrat side. I thought that was great.
Well, see, that's what the smart candidates are doing. The dumb candidates, like, let's say, John Kasich, even Rand Paul learned his lesson this time. Rand Paul has been trying to go after Trump, and Trump has beaten his brains in, and Trump beat Kasich's brains in.
Yes.
But these guys who go up there and try to be negative, I mean, think about this. You have a huge field. If you're at the back of it, how does it help you to cut somebody else down?
Yeah.
It really doesn't, because all that's going to happen is their supporters are going to move on to someone other than you. Really, you've got to go out right now. It's all about showing people your merits, what you can do. And I think these guys, if they're smart, would pick that up. And some of them have, but the ones who haven't, they're the ones at the back of the pack. You know, Kasich, Perry's out now. Jindal, who I like, but he's stuck down at the bottom. He's been doing that. These guys are just not learning the lesson the way they should.
No, they certainly have not. And, it's just a typical branding issue. You've got to show how you're better and not showing how much the person that obviously a lot of people already like by trying to say that he's not the right choice. The other point that you bring up, though, is why do the Republican leadership keep putting their candidates into these kinds of terrible debates? Once again, Rince Priebus and the GOP leadership just flat out fail their candidates, as far as I can see.
And they put out a statement last night saying, hey, we thought this was unacceptable. And I think they probably did a better job this year than they did last year at doing this. However, still, again, the Democrats don't ever have this. It was funny. The Democrats, after their debate, congratulated themselves. We just had a substance-filled issue. We weren't any attacks on our stage. Well, yeah, they didn't ask them any questions.
That's right.
They didn't ever say, Bernie Sanders, why is Hillary Clinton wrong when she says this? Do you think she's crooked? They didn't really do that.
Mm-mm.
So I think when you when the way the debates are set up are disadvantageous to the Republicans a lot of times.
Well, yes, I guess I'm just curious, in terms of these debates, do the Democrats have any kind of debate scheduled on Fox?
I don't know for sure. I know they've got six debates total scheduled, they're already down to a three-person field. It's really Bernie and Hillary debating each other.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they have anything scheduled on Fox.
Well, it'll be interesting if they do, but it's just I look at this and it's just I don't understand what the RNC is thinking to set up debates with far left media outlets. I mean, what's next? Huffington Post going to be moderating the debate?
Well, they might as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that was very, like I say, it was very biased. It was very, and it's not even so much that they're asking them tough questions. I want them to ask these guys tough questions, but a lot of times it comes from a perspective of tone.
Yes.
It's an insulting tone to it. And also the other thing is they're trying to set them up. It's like George Stephanopoulos did last time around. Mitt, what do you think about birth control? And everybody's like, what is that coming from? Well, it's set up for later in the campaign. Well, they're doing the same sort of stuff now.
Yeah.
They're trying to set these guys up to find angles for the Democrats to attack them. And I think, again, they just really need to even this out a little bit more. And again, I like tough questions for these guys, but, you know, you can be tough without being disrespectful.
Yes, I agree. And speaking of being disrespectful, you mentioned Kasich really didn't improve anything, and certainly Bush did not. What do you think of the other ones? What grades would you give them?
Two things. One, I did look this up while we're talking. The Democrats are not doing any debates on Fox. So that tells
surprise.
You something. Yeah, that's the big audience, right? I mean, they didn't want anybody seeing how much Hillary's, you know, could poorly she would do. I mean, they've already anointed her. They don't want her to get hurt in these debates. Kasich bombed. Jeb bombed. Jeb got crushed twice.
Oh, he did.
He got crushed on fantasy football, of all things. First of all, it's sort of baffling. You listen to him, he's talking about it, and he's like, I don't think the government should be regulated, but somebody should be regulating fantasy football.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, my God, that's exactly what we need, a Republican president who wants to regulate fantasy football.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that same thing is that, you know, Jeb's answers to a lot of these questions are, well, we just need to have more government. Well, I'm sorry. Isn't that what Hillary says?
Yeah. It's puzzling. This is a guy who is so out of step with it. It's funny because you hear Donald Trump say, I evolved, and he evolved to the right. And that's where all these guys have done. Jeb was a pretty conservative governor, but it's pretty clear he's evolved to the left.
Yes,
since he's gotten out of office. And it shows he is very, very out of touch with the base. It's almost like he's coming out and saying, all right, well, go ahead and elect me, and I'll deign to serve you serfs out there. You'll be lucky enough to have another Bush in the White House. And he's sort of puzzled. Well, people don't want that. So that's Jeb. Kasich was terrible. Kasich made the horrible mistake. Every person except for Carly Farina, who was tangled with Trump, has gotten their brains beaten in. Kasich got his brains beaten in, too. So he sounded terrible. He sounds very grating and annoying. He's either sounding like a Republican Jimmy Carter, or he's just sounding very obnoxious, one of the two. So I mean, his campaign was so – he sounded so bad last night. I would say this about him. I'd say it about Jeb. Rand were so bad he should probably drop out.
Yeah.
Rand, I hate to say it, same thing. Rand Paul, the more he talks, the less people like him in these debates. He was not bad last night owing to the fact that he finally figured out he shouldn't.
There's just a sourness to him.
Yeah, he is. You know what it is? I'm going to tell you, Rand is not really equipped for this. He is not one of these people like, and I'll use him as an example, Bill Clinton, who, you know, listen, whatever you say about him, he loves people. He loves to be in the middle of the crowd. There is nothing better for a guy like that than to be in the middle of 50 people who want to slap him on the back. Rand is not like that. I've been to events at these different conferences where he's at, and Rand Paul's there, and I can never make it in time to get him.
Wow.
He's in and out of there in like 3 minutes because he doesn't like shaking hands. He doesn't like all this debating. He's very wonkish up there. He is kind of sour. He is he's not going anywhere in this thing, and he's not going to go anywhere. And if I were him, I would drop out and go ahead and focus on his Kentucky Senate race.
Yeah.
That's probably where he needs to go.
That's probably a good idea. You know, let's actually interrupt right here, and we'll come back with some more thoughts on the debate. Everyone stay with us. Lots more with John Hawkins. And thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to John Hawkins, doing some wrap-up on political things this week. John owns the conservative blog Right Wing News, which features terrific news and insight from a conservative point of view. Stop feeding the liberal news machine. Head to rightwingnews.com instead. John, we're talking about the candidates here, and so let's maybe shift into the rest of the candidates. How would you grade somebody like a Trump?
I don't think Trump had a great night. Part of that was because they hit him. He got very hostile questions. And Trump, on certain questions, uses the same response. I don't think that's unusual. Like you ask him about these casinos in Atlantic City. He's going to use the exact same response every time. He also got caught in a fib. And he got caught pretty badly. They asked him about Marco Rubio being carrying water for Mark Zuckerberg, and he just completely, utterly, flat out denied he said it, and he did say it.
Yeah, I kind of remembered him saying that. I thought he was wrong on that.
Well, they actually came back and read it, and I looked it up during the debate. He definitely said that. So it's kind of, he just flat out denied it. So I don't think he had a great night. He did rip up Kasich. I thought he sounded very good when he was talking about gun-free zones. He could still use, and this is one of his things, he is not quite specific enough on the issues. It would be better to have him get into a little bit more detail, which is not, that's not really his strong suit, but as the debates go on, people are going to want more of that. So I don't think Trump had, he did great in a lot of the online polls because he has a lot of fans out there who love him, but I don't think he had a particularly good performance. There's not going to be anybody who's watched this debate who's going to be going Trump because of it. And I like Donald Trump. I'm not one of these people who thinks Donald Trump's, you know, the Antichrist. I think he's great. Ben Carson does not sound good in these debates. And he sounds good in person. He's got a speaking style that's very slow, and it's very measured, and it's a little sleepy. And he sounds like that. And he sounds very good and very serious in person, but when he gets on the stage with these big personalities, he just...
He gets swallowed up, yeah.
I mean, I know a guy who likes him who calls him Sleepy Smurf. Because it's like what he sounds like. And again, I like Ben Carson, but he doesn't sound good in these debates, and he sounds pretty dull. And that's what he sounded like this time. So he didn't – I don't think Ben Carson helped himself. He probably hurt himself a little.
Yeah.
Carly Farina?
The questions that I expected last night, especially when they got into such snark factors, I really expected them to bring out the whole Seventh-day Adventist thing with Ben Carson and try to pick a fight there.
Oh, they'll get around to it. Don't worry. There'll be some moderator who wants to pick a fight. The thing is, he's so likable that people resent it when you say anything about him because he is just a phenomenally likable guy.
Yes, audience definitely booed when he took that one question, for sure.
Right. They don't like that stuff, and I understand that. I do like the fact that they touched on the Medicare question for him because Kasich could have brought it up in a lot nicer way. Kasich just doesn't know how to handle stuff. But
no, he doesn't.
I have to tell you, I don't think anybody, and I'm being perfectly honest, can get elected to be president of the United States when they're promising to get rid of Medicare.
No, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I like Carson.
Not yet. That's a societal shift, and that's never going to happen in just one single election cycle. It just won't happen. What about Rubio and Cruz?
Rubio, Cruz, and Christie were the big three. And the funny thing
I'd
is Christie usually does pretty well on these, but his numbers don't go up very much. I don't know if that's because people are just so negative with him, but he sounded great tonight. I mean, if you ask one of the best people on the stage, Chris Christie was up there. Rubio sounded very good. They hit him with some hostile questions, and he pivoted seamlessly. I have to tell you, when they tried to hit him on that attack line Jeb has been using about his attendance record in the Senate, well, it's sort of a technical thing, and most people don't care about it. And he beat their brains in with it, and the crowd is clapping along. They agree with Rubio, and then Jeb, showing no political instincts whatsoever, attacked him on the same thing.
Yes.
And Rubio beat his brains in with it. So
I think Jeb had a line that he just couldn't wait to use, and he was going to use it regardless. So a bad sense of timing. I thought Cruz did quite well. So he certainly led the fight there against the media.
Yeah, this was the breakout debate for Cruz, because Cruz never sounds bad, but he's not a guy who typically gets off a lot of lines. And this time he did. He actually had the best moment of the debate. I think Frank Luntz said his focus group was the highest they'd ever scored anything.
Yeah,
And I thought it was great. To me, I saw the moment I saw him do that thing, I knew he was going to win the debate. I think he's going to get a bump out of the polls in it. I think he sounded very, very good. And he was solid on other things, too. He sounded better than Rand Paul when he was talking about auditing the Fed. He sounded
good. Yeah, wasn't that interesting? Yeah, he did. Yeah. Okay. All right. We need to go to break now. We're going to wrap things up with John Hawkins coming up. We're going to be talking about Paul Ryan and the whole shift of leadership in the House. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us. We're in our final segment now with John Hawkins of Right Wing News, offering some great insights from a conservative standpoint. And so, John, we had a shift of leadership here in the House, and how fitting was it that Boehner's last act as Speaker was to strike a deal with Democrats and spit in the eye of Republicans? That deal only managed to pass because more than two times as many Democrats supported it than Republicans. 79 Republicans voted for it, 187 Democrats voted for it. So, you know, here we have Paul Ryan, who going into that was blustering, saying, well, this wouldn't happen under my leadership, and yet then he turns around and supported it. So what's your initial thoughts as on a Paul Ryan speakership?
I don't love Paul Ryan. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. I'm especially concerned about him on immigration. I think he's definitely a big believer in open borders and amnesty.
Yeah.
Now, what I will say beyond that is I think you start out with where you at and where are you going from there. So you start out with John Boehner. I was so thrilled they got rid of the guy. I mean, yeah. To me, yeah. It's not just enough to get rid of Barack Obama. You had to get rid of Boehner and McConnell to really get anything done in the country. And McConnell, we still got to get rid of him, but Boehner's gone. So then they wanted, of course, to replace him with his lieutenant, Kevin McCarthy, and they shot him down too, which was beautiful.
Well, he kind of shot himself down, I think, on that one.
I think he didn't have the votes, and he knew he didn't. And then the whole thing they were worried about too, that the whole thing that they were going to get a big discussion about is there are people who are saying he had an affair with Renee Elmers or having one. Who knows if that's true or not? That was certainly a factor, I think, in him, you know, shutting this thing down. So that didn't happen. So then we get Paul Ryan up there. Now, Paul Ryan, you know, he's done some good things. I don't want to say the guy's all bad. I really love the budget plan he came up with. And initially they were reporting his whole thing was, well, everybody's got to vote for me, and I'm going to get rid of the method of getting rid of me. I don't want anybody to be able to take me down, and I'll do it if everybody just agrees. You know, as to that, I would have just told him to, you know, get lost. But apparently what he supposedly said when he went to the Freedom Caucus was, yeah, I'm willing to agree to a lot of these rule changes you want. I'm willing to to not retaliate against you guys for votes of conscience. We're going to take things through regular order. We're going to adhere to the Hassert rule while I'm here. And I think if he actually does these reforms that people are asking for, I think he's fine. I would be perfectly okay with him. For example, you cannot get an amnesty bill through the House if you stick to the Hassert rule. It's not going to happen. So that's the kind of – or getting more Republicans on these committees so that these conservatives actually have a voice in what's going on, giving these guys a chance to have a say in this legislation. It's very, very important. I mean, they won't even – like Boehner will not even let you put your name on a bill if you're a conservative. Like someone like Louie Gohmert cannot get legislation considered by the House because he's Louie Gohmert. So – having Paul Ryan do that, if he actually does these things, like he supposedly has told the Freedom Caucus he will, I think he can do just fine as Speaker. But we're going to have to see what happens when he has that first big fight.
Yeah,
and that's where the rubber meets the road.
That's right. Yeah, the proof will be in the pudding at that point. So you mentioned the it's not enough to just get rid of Obama, but also need to get rid of Boehner. Any sense that we might be getting rid of McConnell at all?
That's an interesting question. I don't know for sure. I'm not hearing any rumblings that they're getting ready to get rid of him.
I haven't either, yeah.
But I think that would be something, if it happened, that would have to happen, you know, next time up. It would have to happen after the 2016 elections. And a lot of that depends on who's the president. Like, let's say it were Ted Cruz or Donald Trump. I think it would be a lot more likely that McConnell would go. You know, can you imagine Ted Cruz as president? McConnell, there's no way he could stay in there. But it would just sort of depend. And, you know, part of the problem we have, too, is they let these things go for so long. It's like with the debt limit. Everybody says they don't want to raise the debt limit. Well, after you've already spent the money, you're going to raise the debt limit. There's no question it's going to happen. Or like what they did with this budget deal. Well, they didn't run it through any kind of regular order. They sat there and the leadership negotiated with the Democrats at the last minute. Well, you've already screwed it up. By that point, you're going to pass something. And it's going to be a mess. And that's the position they keep putting themselves in, because they don't do this stuff right in the first place. You know, if you don't want to raise the debt limit, the time to start cutting spending and doing things is now. It's not two seconds before the debt limit goes
up.
That's
right. Yeah, exactly right.
But yeah, these guys do have to – the key thing with Paul Ryan, and I think this is the one thing that we've got to really see, is what happens when he has a fight.
Yep.
I want to see these guys stand up and fight for something at some point. And you just cannot get anything done in politics ever if you say, well, listen, we're going to do this as long as we don't have to fight for it, because you're going to have to fight for anything it's worth doing.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the Republican sense of fighting has been to roll over and play dead, unfortunately, up till now. So, John Hawkins, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
I love doing the show. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Well, thank you. It is unfortunate, but that is the end of our show for today. I want to thank you so much for joining us. As always, be sure to check iSpyRadio.com. That's iSpyRadio.com, and that's the letter I, not the thing you do the spying with. iSpyRadio.com for some links and some additional information that informed today's show. And, of course, by Mondays at noon, we'll have the podcast up that you can also share. Because, as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.